The masters almost surely have a plan. There's clearly maybe something there beyond the realm of man. And until you've thoroughly tested every last close just
That's true, Dr. Zaius.
Very well.
Where would we be without THC? Cause we know they're lying to us, just don't know to what degree. Yeah, where would we be without THC? The Highest Side Chat Show, Greg Carwood and Company.
All right, Higher Side Chatters, when we examine the crimes of the deep state alphabet agencies, few projects are more nefarious than the mind control and mental manipulation that spiraled out of the world we call MKUltra. Electroshock treatments, fracturing personalities, brain electrode implants, radiation experiments, LSD dosing, and more in the quest for domination over the mental domain. And while we're told MKUltra is long gone, it seems like the mind-bending practices developed during that time and their general knack for brainwashing have only gotten more refined. Well, folks, when you follow these threads on the conspiracy cardigan, you might find yourself in disbelief that the mind of man seems easier to program than a goddamn Roomba. And these influential and suggestive techniques are found everywhere, from advertising and compulsory schooling to religions, cults, and military operations. It's a lot to wrestle with, and we can avoid thinking about it, but it's not going away. So here to talk to us about the history of these projects, separate the facts from the fantasy, and give us a window into the world of mind control is Dr. Colin Ross. Dr. Ross is an internationally renowned clinician, researcher, author, and lecturer in the field of disassociation and trauma-related disorders. He's the founder and president of the Colin A. Ross Institute for Psychological Trauma and has been running a hospital-based trauma program in Dallas, Texas since 1991. He's also authored 29 books and over 200 professional papers, has reviewed for numerous professional journals, and is a past president of the International Society for the Study of Trauma and Disassociation. Some of his book titles include The CIA Doctors, Human Rights Violations by American Psychiatrists, Military Mind Control, A Story of Trauma and Recovery, and The Great Psychiatry Scam. He's a bona fide expert, and I'm psyched to have him here. Dr. Colin Ross, welcome to The Higher Side.
Hey, thanks for having me on board.
Yeah, man, I very much appreciate you coming here to talk to me. We get into subjects like the broad MKUltra umbrella fairly often, but it's rare that someone with a career in the field of psychiatry who's actually read all the declassified documents is willing to come down to my level. So big thanks for that. And to get the ball rolling here, I find that a lot of the time people who have gone through the standard progression of their profession are usually the ones most in denial about the conspiratorial aspects of their wheelhouse. Can you tell us a bit about how your work ended up crossing into these areas that a lot of people wouldn't want to touch?
Sure. So I went into psychiatry from medical school. I did my psychiatry training in Canada. I grew up in Canada from 1981 to 1985. And then I was an academic psychiatrist in Canada from 85 to 91. At that point, when I moved from Canada to Texas, where I've been since, I had zero interest in mind control, CIA, all that kind of stuff. I was starting to hear a little bit about satanic cults, kind of 88-ish, and then 89, 90, 91, quite a bit about it. But I didn't really encounter anybody describing organized satanic cults in Canada. Then late 91, I moved down to the Dallas area and started hearing quite a bit about, well, I grew up in a satanic cult and this happened and that happened. And then within a few months, I started hearing stories of, well, when I was a kid, I was taken to either a military base or some sort of hospital. All these experiments were done on me, and it was some sort of military intelligence, not quite clear set of people. So initially I just thought, I don't think so. That's pretty fantastic. And I decided to look into it. And so looking into it meant reading a fairly small number of books that had been published at that point, nothing in the professional literature at all, and then applying to the CIA through the Freedom of Information Act, and getting the 15,000 pages of MKUltra, Bluebird, Artichoke documents that had all been declassified in the mid-70s. So I really got into it from hearing accounts from patients and thinking, seems pretty doubtful. But the more I got into it, the more documentation, the more evidence built up.
Wow, that's really fascinating. I guess, is it fair to say that it seemed like possibly people who were subjected to this type of stuff in their childhood, maybe they always talk about mental blocks being put on this stuff. Is it fair to say that maybe some of that was dissolving or their programming was breaking down and they were finding themselves going to civilian doctors, or is that a stretch?
No, that's not a stretch at all. That seemed to be what was happening. So, of course, you couldn't go to like the standard textbook and find out what was going on, right? Everybody was kind of scrambling to figure out how much of this is real, how much is not real, how much is going on. Are the psychiatrists being kept under surveillance themselves and the therapists? Are patients being planted in therapies to keep an eye on what the therapists are doing? So there's quite a lot of paranoia and concern and confusion and uncertainty.
Mm-hmm. Well, documents are great because, you know, then we don't have to guess. And having read through the MKUltra documents that were released, even though they're probably only a fraction of this type of stuff, what can you tell us about where they officially start and end?
Well, first of all, the public domain documents are definitely just the tip of the iceberg.
Mm-hmm.
And World War One started, as we know, with the attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941, and then U.S. got involved. And during the 1941-1942 era, there was a move made to sort of organize and centralize U.S. intelligence services because they're kind of scattered and discombobulated. So this resulted in creation of the Office of Strategic Services, which became the precursor of the CIA. Then in 1945, when the war came to an end, the Office of Strategic Services was dissolved, but all the personnel who had been part of it basically became members of the CIA when it was created in September 1947, including Wild Bill Donovan, who was the head of the OSS, whose statue stands in the entrance to the CIA headquarters in Langley. So the CIA was created in 1947. The first documented mind control program was Bluebird, which was signed into existence by the director of the CIA, April 1950. And that's an important date because a lot of the disinformation that's been put out is, well, we were only reacting to what the communist Chinese were doing. All of our mind control efforts were entirely defensive in nature. And we were getting these false confessions of germ warfare by our pilots who had been captured and interrogated and brainwashed by the Chinese. So in reaction to that, we had to try and figure out what was going on. But we never used it offensively. That's the disinformation, which is disproven by the fact that the first declassified program was April 1950, and the Korea War didn't start until June 1950. So then Bluebird went on for a few years. It was rolled over into Artichoke, and then Artichoke was rolled over into MKUltra, which ran from 54-ish to 64. And then MKUltra was rolled over into MKSearch, which ran until 1972-73. And then after that, everything's still classified.
Mm.
And then parallel with Bluebird, Artichoke, MKUltra, MKSearch, there was a series of other projects, MKNaomi, Project Often, Project Darby Hat, Project Third Chance. And some of those, there's just a handful of pages of documents. So that's kind of the basic timeline and history of it. And people often say that they either were involved in MKUltra or are currently involved in MKUltra, because they use MKUltra as kind of a umbrella term for all the mind control programs. But technically, that's not correct, because MKUltra was a specific program that ran from mid-50s to mid-60s.
Mm-hmm. And I've actually heard you say in previous interviews that, of course, MKUltra is the most well-known, but it's actually kind of mild compared to the details of some of the other programs. Which of the programs that you've seen, even if the information is scarce, which ones seem to be the most extreme?
Project Often is the one that's the most extreme in terms of, there's a movie called Jacob's Ladder that was in the 70s, I think it was made. And it's a story that starts off with a big combat scene in the jungle of Vietnam. And this U.S. soldiers are totally freaked out on some sort of trip, like hallucinogen trip. And then it flashes back and there's all kinds of plot twists and so on. But there's a very paranoid chemist in the film who says that he's aware of this drug BZ, which has been used in Vietnam. So I thought that was just a Hollywood thing. It turns out that BZ is an actual compound that was tested by the U.S. Army, and it's a kind of super LSD. So a BZ trip can last many days and be much more intense. And Project often describes hallucinogen experiments where people are 3 to 4 days totally, like, way, way, way up there, paranoid, hallucinating. So the side effects of Project Often experiments include paranoia that lasts ongoing, all kinds of things.
Wow.
So that was the most extreme. A lot of the MKUltra projects were just, they kind of divide into thirds. A third of them were just basically industrial contracts, like to produce a certain chemical or a drug or something that they wanted to use. A third of them were just kind of bland general academic contracts to gather some research information on some subject. And the purpose of that was kind of twofold. One was just to see if the CIA could learn something about something of interest or form a relationship with the investigator and then later on bring them into the fold, give them security clearance and so on. And then about a third of them were actual mind control experiments, where the contractors were cleared at top secret, knew what was going on, knew it was CIA money and so on. But even those ones, as described in the documents, weren't that horrific.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been into this stuff for a while, and I sometimes find myself wondering where the line is between the truth and the general conspiracy world sensationalism. But even I've seen some of those key documents that make it seem quite easy to control the mind, even to that level of having someone fire a gun and then they have no memory of it. And I'm pretty sure what I saw was from a .gov archive, but what sort of actual results have you seen in these documents from the experiments themselves?
That's mostly from the Bluebird artichoke documents. So we're in the first half of the 50s. And they describe a number of things very clearly, very explicitly. So the first point is not everybody is equally hypnotizable. And that's well known in hypnosis literature. So depends on what cutoff you use, but 5 to 10% of people are quite highly hypnotizable. 5% at least can, like, really block out physical pain, can have hypnotically induced amnesia, and a stage hypnotist can make that happen. There's huge literature on that. It's not disputed. And basically, it seems that the mind control programs figured out how to select these people. They don't describe the selection criteria very clearly. But people who are prone to hypnosis, they would do things like hypnotize a secretary at the CIA, have her go into a room, retrieve some documents, bring them back, bring her out of hypnosis. She'd have no memory. One experiment describes they hypnotize somebody and then they put a post-hypnotic signal in, which is if they say a certain phrase, she goes into a trance state. So it's just a normal day and somebody says that signal word to her. She goes into a trance state. She's given a briefcase. She delivers it to another person who's in a trance state. And the person who's receiving it thinks that it's a bomb and that they are going to go and blow something up with that bomb. And then there's also experiments where the person is told to shoot somebody that they know and they pull the trigger thinking it's a loaded gun. And then afterwards, they have no memory for having done that. It's very clearly described. You don't have to read between the lines at all. It's not a hard thing to do just with a fairly simple experiment in a few hours. To get a really fully conditioned person, again, it's not clearly described, but it's months of conditioning, preparation, training.
Hmm. Fascinating, man. And in your bio, I saw something about you had spent a lot of time in Shanghai, actually, at the medical center and done some work over there. And I'm curious because culture and many other factors affect mental condition. Do you have any insight from your work in the East? Any notable differences in psychiatry there and here?
Yes and no. So I got into that because a colleague of mine had been over there on a kind of cultural exchange, touring different mental hospitals program. And he had met the woman who was then the director of Shanghai Mental Center. And they got talking and she was interested in trauma and dissociation. So we went over there and did a series of visits and organized and carried out some research projects and published a whole series of papers. So number one, it was an incredibly interesting experience. And the people that I worked with were very pleasant, very friendly, very, very hardworking. So I was interested in finding out a little bit about traditional Chinese medicine and how it blends in. And Shanghai Mental Health Center itself is very Western psychiatry oriented, making diagnoses, lots of medications being prescribed and so on. And immediately across the street, there was a school for traditional Chinese medicine. One time I went in there with one of the people who worked at Shanghai Mental Health Center because he was picking up some herbs. So we go into the pharmacy and there's like dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of jars of all kinds of leafy looking things and roots and powders. And It was like you had traveled 10,000 miles just walking across the street, because back at Shanghai Mental Health Center, they really kind of poo-pooed and downplayed and said, oh, well, you know, that traditional stuff isn't really done in the cities anymore. It's really out in the country and we don't do that here. But when they got to know us a little better and they kind of opened up and found out we weren't going to criticize the heck out of them, then they obviously themselves personally were using traditional Chinese herbs and medicine all the time. But it's really not integrated into the professional side of things. And so I noticed a whole bunch of interesting things. So one was, first of all, not at the hospital. So I'm in Tiananmen Square walking around in Beijing because we did a couple of trips to Beijing. And just a regular tourist. Here's this giant square with parliament buildings on both sides. Mao's tomb is there. There's a big statue that's got about six or seven or eight different people, like the revolutionary soldier and the woman with the baby and the guy with the scythe who's been out in the fields and so on. And then at the far end of Tiananmen Square is the largest McDonald's in the world. So that was very contradictory. So I'm standing there and I'm looking around. And in Tiananmen Square, there's these metal poles. They're kind of like telephone poles. They're maybe a foot or a little less in diameter at the bottom, maybe 80-ish feet high. I look up to the top of one and a little box at the top goes, looks directly at me and a little red light goes, flip. So clearly some government guy was doing face recognition check on me. And then the other funny thing like that experience was at the hotel that we stayed at near the hospital, which was more of a regular Chinese people hotel, not the big downtown tourist hotel. There's no place to work out. You can't go for a run because it's so crowded and the air's not too hot. So I was running stairs in the hotel for some exercise. So I run up to the top floor. It wasn't a real big hotel. And I notice, oh, there's one more floor. So I thought I might as well go up that one last floor. I get up to the top and I look to the left. And here's this room, like 15 by 20 foot room, crammed with listening equipment, with this guy in a military uniform who looks at me and looks kind of startled. And I kind of wave at him and head myself back down the stairs.
Wow.
So they have listening devices and every room is bugged.
Mm.
And so like you can't talk about political stuff in your hotel room. And I noticed a couple things like that. And then we were talking about a future research project and where could we interview people? Like I personally wouldn't do the interviews, but where could the interviewers get hold of people who cut on themselves and self-mutilate? Because that's one of the areas I study and work with. Well, we could go to an emergency department. I said, oh, how many emergency departments are there in Shanghai? 100. It's so huge. So we talked about that for a while. And then I said, well, what about going to a battered spouse shelter? Well, we don't have any of those. Well, what about going to a prison and interviewing female inmates in a prison? Because they have high rates of trauma and abuse. Oh, you wouldn't be allowed in there.
Hmm.
Why not? Well, you might see things you're not supposed to see.
Huh.
Those were the kind of little glimpses into the totalitarian state that I got. And then the other one is in their diagnostic manual. So they have a sort of Chinese version of the DSM, which is much, much thinner. Half of it's in Chinese and half is in English. So it's really quite a thin little book. And it's got some diagnoses that pretty closely resemble U.S. ones like depression. But one of their diagnoses is Qigong overutilization disorder. So Qigong is a thousands of year old variation on Tai Chi, except it's more stationary, sitting, meditating kind of practice.
Mm-hmm.
And the Falun Gong people, who are the guys who are always getting disappeared and arrested and thrown in psychiatric hospitals, they are big on Qigong practice. So Qigong overutilization disorder is defined as somebody who's doing it many, 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 many hours per day and totally obsessed with it, and it's interfering with their function and their life and so on, which sort of kind of makes sense. But one of the criteria for diagnosing this disorder is, which then means you require psychiatric treatment, one of the criteria is thinking bad thoughts about the government.
Ah.
So that's kind of like the sum total of what I saw on the totalitarian state side of things. On the more just clinical side of it, my main focus was on the similarities and finding classical cases of undiagnosed multiple personality, dissociative identity disorder, which we did find. But the whole culture obviously works very differently. So I talked to a whole series of women who had been in the mental hospital 9 months, 2 years, 2.5 years. So I'm talking to them through an interpreter. And a typical story would be, well, how long have you been in the hospital? 2.5 years. When are you thinking you might get discharged? I'm not sure, maybe next spring. Says, why were you admitted? Well, my mental illness. So I kind of figured that was probably likely to be the case, right? So, okay, what kind of mental illness? Well, I don't know. I was just having symptoms. So this woman's telling me she has mental illness, and what are the symptoms? I'm trying to get something out of her. And it's, well, I was having headaches. Anything else? Well, I wasn't being a very good wife. Oh. And that'd be about all I could get out of her. And then it's, well, okay, so you've been here for 2.5 years. What was the treatment you got as soon as you arrived at the hospital? Well, I got a lot of electric shock. Oh, okay. And what symptoms are you having now? Well, none. I'm better. So why aren't you thinking you're going to be going home for another 6 months or so? Well, my husband's not ready to have me come home yet. So the doctors are not allowed to discharge the person until the family agrees to it.
Mm.
People are getting thrown, wives mostly, are getting thrown in by their families and getting stuck in the hospital for years.
Damn, that's dark. And it sounds kind of like the program is sucking people deeper into the system, just like it seems to here too. You go in for something maybe minor, and then you, all of a sudden you're deep, deep, deep into their treatment, quote unquote.
Right, except China's kind of where we were in the 50s, right? Which is mainly due to the economics of the healthcare system. So insurance companies just will not pay for long lengths of stay. And the state hospitals have downsized, and there's just not that many beds available to put people in for years and years and years and years. So that's why there's so many people are on the street or dead. So really, unless you really got sent off to rendition on some island in the Indian Ocean or something, most of the time you can't get stuck in a psychiatric hospital for too long these days, unless you like murder somebody or something. But just a regular civilian person, the average length of stay in a general adult unit these days is a week or less.
Hmm.
So as a recruitment funnel for a mind control program, general regular psychiatric hospitals don't work that well anymore, I don't think.
Hmm. Man, so another thing I was going to ask you about, because I learned that it seems like he had some personal conversations with Sidney Gottlieb before he died. And
yeah, I gave him a call. His phone number wasn't that hard to find. And that was an interesting conversation. So Sidney Gottlieb was the head guy for MKUltra. He kind of got jerked around by the CIA, basically, because all these guys basically sign national security oaths, so they can't tell you too much. You know, it's a guild that protects itself, and there's kind of a operating principle that you don't hang people out to dry. And you know, they're all part of the company and so on. And so there's all these MKUltra documents that get released, 15,000 pages, and everybody's names are whited out or redacted. Except just by mistake, a number of different times, Sidney Gottlieb's name was not redacted, which is how he got identified in public and then interviewed and so on. So he wasn't too happy about that.
Yeah.
So I called him up and said, "Hi, I'm Colin Ross, and this is what I'm doing." And he just started chatting away. And I said, "Well, I'm reading documents and writing a book about MKUltra and so on. And I know that you were head of it. And I'm particularly interested in a couple of individuals, one of them being Martin Orne, who's a psychiatrist who was cleared at Top Secret." And he's like, Martin Orne. He's pretending like he can't remember who he is. I says, "Oh yeah, Martin Orne, MKUltra subproject such and such, cleared at Top Secret, 1953. Oh yeah, Martin Orne." And then that was the same thing with Jolly West. Yeah, this was his MKUltra subproject this year, cleared at Top Secret. He worked on the following. Oh yeah, Jolly West. So it was kind of this tap dance, and he's rather vague and wasn't giving me much information that wasn't already out in the public for decades. But the one comment he made that was interesting was, "Oh, well, there was another unit besides mine."
Mm.
And then he sort of went on to something else, and then that was the end of the conversation. So that's a completely still classified program, which has not been identified. We don't know anything about who was in it, what they did. The only little clue I found through my other investigations is there's a place called the Texas Research Institute for Mental Sciences, and the head psychiatrist was this guy, Neil Birch, who's very connected into the network of mind control doctors, all of which is totally documented in my book. And he has the TRIMS documents list Air Force contract, and there's a contract number and who the investigator was and what it was for and the amount of money and so on. And there's three CIA contracts with the amount of money. Doesn't say what they're for exactly, but the cryptonym is XG hyphen and then some numbers. And that doesn't correspond to any of the known programs. So there's definitely been one or more, probably a bunch of programs running in parallel to the MKUltra era that are still classified that we don't know anything about at all.
Right. That's fascinating to think about. And I guess I would wonder, I mean, if I'm piecing the story together, you know, a person might ask, why would they declassify any of this stuff? It seems like maybe they had to because of those people that were coming in to civilian doctors and such. They had to give up something. And it seems like maybe they threw Sidney under the bus and just said, "Hey, these people were supposed to have these memories blocked and suppressed, and now they're coming out. So we're going to throw you under the bus and your program under the bus." And it's just like a kind of a limited hangout thing to give people something to chew on without really giving them the full scope of what happened. Is that the gist of it as you see it?
Yeah, I think so. So you have to be aware of the sequence, though. So the church committee and a big round of declassification of documents happened in the mid-70s. And people really didn't start coming into civilian therapies and talking about this mind control stuff until maybe a handful, but basically late 80s and into the early 90s. So that whole round of declassification was not driven by people starting to talk about it in civilian therapies much at all. So one was, it was just a bunch of political pressure. And so they had to cough up something. So the story that's told all the time is, in 1973, Richard Helms, who was the head of the CIA, ordered Gottlieb to destroy all of the MKUltra, MKSearch documents, which he did, except somehow seven boxes of documents sitting in a warehouse were never shredded. And then by random chance in the 70s, somebody discovered these, and they ended up getting declassified. So that's the story. Which is possible, but probably a cover story. And it's exactly what you said then, probably. A limited hangout is an actual term. So when you read background books about CIA and intelligence community in general, you've learned that this is a term used in the intelligence community. A limited hangout is a strategy where you let out a little bit of the truth to cover up the greater part of the truth. And it seems like Ewan Cameron, who was an MKUltra contractor in Montreal, was thrown under the bus, publicly identified, Gottlieb, and one other guy, and then everybody else's names are still redacted. So it does seem like we got to give them something, so we'll give them a couple little tidbits. And then what was the internal politics behind why Gottlieb got thrown under the bus? No idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a curious thing. And I did want to ask you about the mental hospitals in the 70s and 80s. Obviously, they go back further than that, but a lot of people make the case that the closing of these facilities is the reason why we have so many mentally disturbed homeless people out on the streets. There's no place for them to go. And that is a fair point. But these mental hospitals were hotbeds for abuse and experimentation in a lot of cases, weren't they?
Big time. So there's a whole series of hospitals that were either directly involved or on the periphery. And it's really sort of a diffuse network. So like this doctor published with this doctor, that doctor edited a book that this doctor contributed to, this doctor was at this hospital, and he recruited somebody from that hospital. So it's this web that you have to follow and kind of construct to see how it's really a sort of very distributed network all around the United States, involving not just some fringe lunatics in a basement. So leading universities, Harvard, Yale, UCLA, Tulane, etc., people who were editors of major psychiatric journals, head of the American Psychological Association, things like that. And some hospitals were more directly involved than others. So St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Washington, D.C., that's one of my strongest bets for being heavily involved in this kind of mind control program stuff. A guy named Hudson Hoagland was very much in the network, worked with another guy who was an LSD experimenter at Harvard. So he was involved in this facility and that facility. And this Hudson Hoagland guy wrote a book about just his experience in a normal state mental hospital, late 40s and late 50s, which was the most insane snake pit, fire hoses on the patients kind of place.
Mm.
So that was like average normal state mental hospital back in the 40s, 50s. So to terrorize and brutalize and then pull into mind control programs people out of those hospitals would have been very easy.
Right. And I mentioned this to you in my first email that I've always kind of had a conspiratorial interest in this stuff, but it got a little personal when I learned that my mom had a brother who committed suicide before I was born, and she never mentioned this until it just came up a few years ago. And the story goes that he was gay and was somehow entrapped by an undercover cop and convicted of sodomy and sent to a mental hospital where he underwent a lot of electroshock therapy and these sorts of things to quote unquote fix him. And when he was released, my parents were the ones to pick him up. And apparently he was just broken, a shell of his former self, and ended up pulling the trigger on himself. And I don't know really what you can say to help me better understand what might have happened, but I guess I would ask, how typical would this story be? And what sort of experiences were common for a person who might have been institutionalized for this sort of thing in the 70s?
70s is getting a little bit to the tail end of the declassified mind control programs.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll come back around to this, but there's basically zero possibility that all these programs stopped in 1973. It's completely implausible. And actually, it would be irresponsible, by which I mean there's definitely mind control, double spy, sleeper agent kind of programs being run at the U.S. by terrorists and imposing intelligence agencies and so on. So if we weren't staying up to speed on this and trying to detect when mind control sleeper agents are in the U.S., we wouldn't be doing our job as intelligence agency, military, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's the job of the CIA and the military to be up to speed on this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just not believable that they said, oh, well, we're not even going to think about it anymore in 1973. They have to have active programs. And if they didn't, they wouldn't be doing their job. So to me, it's not even worth discussing whether there's programs active up to the present. Besides which, when you look at what we know in public from photographs and descriptions at Guantanamo Bay and Abu Ghraib, those are well-designed, active mind control programs. Those are not just a few rogue people on the loose. And the elements that we see in the pictures from Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay are basically all the elements that were being studied back in the MKUltra days. Sensory deprivation, sensory isolation, good cop, bad cop techniques, drugs, quotes, enhanced interrogations. Enhanced interrogation is just the current sanitized term for mind control brainwashing. So waterboarding, all these things are just standard interrogation techniques. When you call it mind control, it seems all kind of science fiction and, ooh, we believe it, we don't believe it. When you call it enhanced interrogation, nobody says, that's not real, I don't believe in that. And the purpose of enhanced interrogations are obvious. You're trying to get information out of the person, and you're trying to control their behavior, and you're interested in following them post-discharge and turning them to work for your side. So that's not disputable. So therefore, all these programs are clearly ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I got off the train of thought there.
Oh, no. I was just, I mean, you make a great point that they're just playing with terms, and these programs are very much still alive. In the story that I was told about, you know, this uncle I never knew, the facility in question that I haven't been able to find too much information on either was apparently the Missouri State Hospital in Fulton, Missouri. And I was curious if that hospital ever popped up in the network that you're aware of.
No, I haven't heard anything about that particular hospital. But I have heard about experimentations under the guise of treatment on gay people. So there's Robert Heath, who's a psychiatrist at Tulane. And he's published a whole series of papers having to do with several different things. One is putting electrodes in people's brains and then giving them LSD, mescaline, hallucinogens, and tracking their EEGs to see what happens electrically in their brain when you give them hallucinogens. And also using brain electrode implants to modify people's behavior. And he's directly connected to a series of doctors that did that kind of work. One of his papers, which was, I forget the exact year, but about 1972 or so in the Journal of Nervous and Mental Disease. He describes at Tulane treating a guy for the mental disorder of homosexuality. So in that era, being gay was automatically a mental disorder.
Right.
And so how are we going to treat this? Well, he brings the guy in, and this guy was early 20s. He's in there for about 9 months. They put an electrode in his brain. And this is all in the paper, in the journal. They connect the electrode to a wire, to a belt that he has on, transmitter that he has on his belt. And he can push a button on the transmitter box, which sends a signal to his brain that puts him in kind of a pre-orgasmic state.
Mm.
So he's constantly being sexually aroused. And while he's doing that, he's watching heterosexual pornography. So they're trying to condition him to be straight.
Ugh.
But after a while, they had to take the box away from him because he was pushing it 1,500 times in a period of 3 hours.
Whoa.
And this is just kind of, this is what we do at the hospital, no big deal, just describing our research here. And then towards the end, they brought in a prostitute, had him have sex with the prostitute while monitoring his EEG, and then afterwards, they debriefed the prostitute, who said, yeah, he had an orgasm. He seemed to enjoy it. And then they discharged him, successfully converted to being straight, and said he only had one relapse in the first few months of follow-up. So this is what's published, known facts. So imagine what didn't get published.
Right. Yeah. Jesus Christ. That seems like kind of the template from what I understand happened to my mom's brother. So I wouldn't be surprised. And I want to get a little further into the satanic ritual abuse side of things, because this is another area where torture and trauma is said to fracture personalities. How often have you dealt with patients that might not have been in government programs per se, but had mental damage from cult-like rituals and sexual trauma from a smaller, more private group?
Well, so first of all, caveat. So the sequence of events is I'm in medical school, 77 to 81, nothing about childhood sexual abuse at all. No training, no discussion, nothing. Then 4 years of psychiatry training, 81 to 85, again, basically nothing about childhood sexual abuse, physical abuse, domestic violence, rape, sexual harassment by professional men, including psychiatrists and doctors. Total silence on all of that. And then, of course, what happens is the women's movement starts bringing it out of the closet. There's all these whistleblowers. And next thing we know, the official position of psychiatry has shifted to, well, we always have known there's quite a lot of that going on. We just didn't have the good research. And anyway, it's kind of an iffy area and it's hard to tell. And then that shifted to, oh, well, there's numerous research projects conclusively showing that childhood sexual abuse is relatively common, affecting no less than 5% of boys and 10-15% of girls, if you include, you know, a single act of fondling and so on. More serious, like penetration level incest, though, maybe 5%, not less than 2% of girls in the United States. That's kind of the ballpark of the statistics.
Mm.
And then so it went to, oh yeah, well, that's what's going on. But it's really not that relevant to what we do treatment wise, which is kind of where things are now. So if you go to almost all psychiatric hospitals or almost all outpatient clinics and see a psychiatrist, you're not going to do any kind of therapy work on childhood sexual abuse. No way, it's not happening. So the sequence there was total denial. It's not real. It's not happening. And then with great resistance, step by step, oh yeah, there's tons of childhood sexual abuse going on. Just kind of paralleling what we see in Hollywood today. Oh, there's always the casting couch, but it was kind of a joke and it was kind of a cute thing. And probably the starlets didn't really mind. And now just now it's all coming out that there's been massive sexual crime and victimization going on for decades, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the sequence is total denial and then absolute documentation proof that it's been going on a massive scale. So then late 80s, early 90s, we start hearing about satanic ritual abuse. A lot of talk about it at some conferences in the U.S. And so the question then becomes, okay, how much is real? How much is not real? What kind of conspiracy is there to cover it all up? So I wrote a book called Satanic Ritual Abuse, Principles of Treatment, and read the small amount there was to read on it, no professional literature. And I talked to Kenneth Lanning, who was on the phone, who was supposedly an authority on that, but wasn't really, and tried to track it down. And basically, the more you look into it, it's just like chasing shadows in the fog. You never get to, here's hard, objective, you know, court of law level evidence of organized, multi-generational human sacrifice satanic cults. So then, kind of overlapping that, I start hearing about these military mind control experimentation using people for agents and natural operations. And I'm going, okay, so which pattern is this going to follow? Is this going to be like totally real and the evidence comes out? Or is it going to be just fog and you can't get your fingers on anything solid like the satanic stuff? And it turns out that the more I looked into the military CIA mind control, thousands of pages of documents and names of all the doctors and et cetera piled up. But still to this day with satanic ritual abuse and satanic cults, you can find newspaper clippings of murders with a satanic flavor to them, you know, teenagers who got involved, et cetera. But a really well-organized, high-level group of wealthy people who are basically pedophiles who have kinky sex parties with satanic themes in them, there's no public proof that that stuff exists.
Mm-hmm.
So then that just leaves you with, it's either, you know, false memories or it's extremely well guarded and covered up at a very high level. Those are the only two possibilities.
Right. And I'm sure there's a mix of both in there somewhere.
Probably.
And so this is a weird one, I will admit, but from what I understand, the goal of these satanic or occult fueled groups and this sort of ritual abuse in that context is often to open a person up to entity invocation, that if you torture someone enough, some form of dark contact can be made and a sort of possession can take place. What are your thoughts on these occult aspects of mind control or these kind of claims?
Well, first of all, there's a little twist on this, which is Martin Orne, especially Jolly West, who are top secret cleared under MKUltra, and their projects involved hypnosis, creating dissociative states, etc. They were directly linked to George Estabrooks, who contracted with the War Department and also corresponded with the CIA, and described creating Manchurian candidates in great detail on contract to the military during the Second World War. So these guys, Martin Orr and Jolly West, were consultants during the Korean War on debriefing these downed pilots who had made, quotes, false confessions of germ warfare. So first of all, we have to ask, where is it, false confessions or real confessions? So these guys were the experts on CIA military mind control contracting and programs. And then they became experts on destructive cults and were hostile to destructive cults and saying they're bad and we need to police them and so on. But they originally obtained their expertise on cult mind control methods from being mind control contractors to the U.S. military and then the CIA. So that's very strange and twisted.
Yeah.
And then there's lawsuits back and forth where some of the cults are suing Jolly West and the foundation that was created, which is the Cult Awareness Network. So the Cult Awareness Network is saying, you guys are cults. And the cults are saying, well, we're just an organization and a religion. And there's a whole, you know, side story with many rabbit holes in it following all of that. So it's an extremely convoluted and twisted history that connects into the Patty Hearst kidnapping, JFK assassination, all kinds of things. But you can never really follow it, like I said, to this hardcore proof. But when you go to just life in general, I mean, people are always trying to control people, right? So what's the purpose of advertising? It's to, quotes, mind control people and get them to buy Pepsi instead of Coke.
Mm-hmm.
So how to influence people, change their behavior, change their preferences, change their perceptions. I mean, it's been going on since before ancient China, right?
Right.
And so a lot of it is not really particularly mysterious. It's just general control methods. And like any kind of indoctrination in a non-cult, just regular organized religion, then you get into cults, which can be New Age cults, psychotherapy cults, Christian cults, all different flavors of cults. How those people operate and what they do is very well described in a large literature. Like if you want somebody to be a suicide bomber in the Middle East, you don't just walk up and say, hey, how'd you like to blow yourself up tomorrow? Right? I mean, you got to get hold of them and you got to work on them and indoctrinate them somehow. And that involves often a lot of cultural, religious kind of pressures, financial rewards to the family. You're going to get your 70 virgins in heaven. And we notice that most of the people who blow themselves up are between 15 and 30. There's not too many of the 55-year-old male bosses blowing themselves up.
Hmm.
It's all just kind of built on this foundation of what we know about life in general. So then we get to the more secretive cults that we can't prove exist, but they're just slightly elaborated, one-level-up versions of what we do know exists.
Mm-hmm.
And in the actual documents, it describes creating new personality states that can be assigned mission tasks, and then the out-front person doesn't have any knowledge or memory of the mission at all. Rationale being, if they're caught and interrogated, they don't know anything.
Yeah.
So it's not so much, I think, getting people to do stuff they wouldn't ordinarily do. If you want somebody to go out and kill a bunch of people, you just put them through basic training and send them out to a war zone, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's no mysterious mind control required. These mind control people, they don't do stuff that ordinary soldiers and spies never do. So I think it's really the amnesia and the resistance to interrogation that has to be the rationale for it. And creating these new identity states that didn't exist before. So then that edges over into, okay, is this identity state literally a separate person? Well, no, not really. It's really a separated off part of the person. But if you look at that through a spiritual lens, then this newly created entity can say, I'm Beelzebub, or I'm so-and-so, or I'm so-and-so. And it's some supernatural being. And then the question is, do you believe that it's literally a supernatural being? Or do you think it's just an illusion and it's a psychological thing?
Right.
It's really the same structure and the same sort of technology, whether it's just, quotes, so this George Estabrooks calls it Jones A and Jones B.
Jones B is the artificially created venture and candidate identity that goes on the mission. If you are in some kind of voodoo cult in Haiti, it's going to be the ancestor spirit so-and-so entered the body.
Mm-hmm.
But it's all basically the same structure and psychological process.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense that a lot of that is kind of just injected culture or superstition or sensationalism, and that forming a different personality is basically the same thing as forming, a person thinking they're a demon. They might as well just think they're, Joe the Plumber. It's right. Just like a weird cultural thing. And it is harder to get a handle on those weirder aspects. But I guess I would ask, just to go down this rabbit hole a little bit more, contact with some form of consciousness or intelligence is really the front and center topic for the psychedelic communities. And I've had experiences like that myself. They don't involve programming necessarily, just the right chemicals.
Right.
And I've even had some guests suggest that when these government mind control programs started, they did just want to know the best way to break a person down. But eventually they realized they were opening up a Pandora's box of communication with something else. And that maybe programs that split off were done to further explore that aspect. And I guess I would ask, have you seen anything to indicate that that could be true, or which programs in particular might have explored those threads? Or do you think we can just chalk that up to, what you were saying before, the cultural overlay of multiple personalities?
Well, that's a bunch of questions. So my answers are yes, yes, no, and maybe. One at a time. So there's a good movie, which was very funny and entertaining movie, Men Who Stare at Goats.
Yeah.
Which is based on a book. So that's not just fiction. There actually was military intelligence programs to look into, quotes, the paranormal. And there actually were experiments to see if you could kill a goat using your mind. So that's history that actually happened. Now, how good was anybody at actually killing a goat with their mind? We don't know for a fact. But there were such programs looking into that. And there's a series of programs. 84, I think, was the first year. And the program was called Stargate, which has been declassified. I remember watching a Nightline episode with Ted Koppel interviewing Robert Gates, who had been the head of the CIA at the time, the guy who was the liaison between the CIA and the military. And Stargate was run out of Fort Meade. And basically the purpose of Stargate was to recruit people. And the names of a bunch of these people are public, and some of them are written biographies and so on. And they're connected in with the Stanford Research Institute as well. And basically they would go into a room. So they would have some training, and they would have some psychic ability, talent. And they would lie down in kind of a dim room, quiet. And they either would be given specific longitude, latitude coordinates, or they would be told, there's down plane somewhere in Central America. We want you to go find it. And then they would astral project, or it's called remote viewing.
Mm-hmm.
And they would go to the scene, and they would go, oh, well, there, yeah, there's the aircraft. It's here. The pilots are dead. Or they would go, I'm inside the Russian missile base or submarine base, and here's the layout, and here's what's going on. So the Robert Gates was going, I don't really buy it. And the liaison guy was saying, no, we actually got usable intelligence that was confirmed by other sources that we used operationally. So that's what's being discussed, on mainstream network news program.
Mm-hmm.
So that definitely existed, definitely happened. And the budget was $20 million.
Damn.
So, and that's, again, just tip of the iceberg, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they must have spent hundreds of millions. And why would they keep spending and spending and spending and spending and spending if there was no usable intelligence? So that kind of edges out into what you hear about but isn't documented, which is they're studying penetrating other people's dreams to kill them in their dreams, resulting in the person in Russia being dead, inducing heart attacks, controlling and influencing somebody through their dreams remotely, all these things.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can't just go to the encyclopedia and get proof of it, right?
Right.
We know that that kind of stuff was looked into, no question, in the Soviet Union and in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Man, fascinating stuff. I am just so glad I could get you here to talk about this stuff. It's really great to have a real working professional who has the education and training, but hasn't been completely indoctrinated to the status quo. You know, you're a rare breed indeed. And
thank you.
No problem. And before I cut you loose, do tell the people a little bit about the Colin Ross Institute and your books and anything else you have going on that they might want to know more about.
So like I said, you can just search me Colin A. Ross, MD, or the Ross Institute. There's another Ross Institute, but the Colin A. Ross Institute for Psychological Trauma, rossinst.com. And then there's buttons to my other websites and my other activities. My company, Manitou Communications, there's all kinds of books that I've published. Or you can just go on Amazon to find all my books. So basically, that's the portal you can enter.
Right on. Well, very cool. Again, thanks so much. I feel like I could do this forever. Hopefully I can have you back sometime because we just scratched the surface on some of these topics and the rabbit hole goes deep. And I appreciate the work you've done, man. Take care of yourself out there.
No, thanks. Thanks for having me. Look forward to talking to you again.
You got it. Me too. Oh, sweet crypto Jesus, dear people of the internet. There you have it. Dr. Colin Ross, an educated and open-minded fellow. I think we ended up with a pretty good expose on mind control, mental trauma, government programs, and all that jazz. Sounds like an excellent title for a musical. If anyone's in the business, you can just have that. You're welcome. But I just learned about the good doctor's work. In fact, I was talking to Chris Knowles about such things, and it was him who recommended I check into having Colin on as a guest, and I'm glad I did. Kudos to Chris for that. And it was also really the strive to find out more about my mom's brother that sort of pushed me in this direction. You heard me asking him about the facility in Fulton, Missouri. You probably heard me ask Jay Parker too. And it's just one of those weird things that I've found out after developing a conspiracy-centric podcast. You know, I thought I grew up in Midwest America with a nice white picket fence and a pretty simple Midwest life, but little did I know, beneath the surface, the oily appendages of the elite have definitely touched my family. It's just one of several personal aspects that has made me a bit more aggressive about certain topics. And I try to keep an eye out for references to that facility or electroshock treatments or scandals, and I haven't found a ton, but I have definitely found some. Here's just a couple of personal stories related to the Fulton, Missouri Mental Hospital that I found online. One says, my dad was at the Fulton State Hospital for an evaluation before they were sending him to state prison. I was just wondering if there was anyone who might have heard about this in a newspaper or television news because he committed suicide while he was there. Another one says, I was working on my family history and found that an ancestor hanged himself at the state hospital in Fulton in 1926. I know it's a long time ago and treatments have changed, well, a little bit, but it's a sad and shocking thing to uncover. It is indeed. Another person says, I was there in the early 60s and there was a young black boy about 9 or 10. He was in the side room on 6th South. We were awakened at about 2 a.m. when he had been horsing around and stood at the end of the bed with a blanket tied around his neck. And they claimed he tripped and that it was an accident. Anyway, he did die, and I've thought about it for years. There was a social worker who molested the younger boys and paid them off with cigarettes. I always wondered if he had anything to do with it. Wow, those are dark accusations. A couple more where a person says, I had a relative commit suicide there. She died in 1962. I understand that she used some form of gasoline or other flammable to ignite herself. And then one more where they say, I worked there in 2007 and was injured, but I can tell you that the, quote, clients aren't treated anywhere near as well as the hospital claims to treat them. The hospital treats their workers bad enough also. So I'm finding a couple things. This place does not sound too fun. And of course, this particular hospital is just one of many with an unsavory history. It's probably not even in the top 50, but that's an even scarier realization. And there's a lot of darkness in that chapter of history, and Big Pharma is still making millions and billions selling their zombie pills that came out of that era and that work. It's so crazy to think that parents used to rush to get their kids pilled up when I was going to school. I like to think that culture has pulled back a little bit, hasn't it? I haven't been plugged into what's happening in grade schools for a while now, except for the whole Common Core conundrum. But I'm pretty sure people have pulled back. Anyway, this show really was booked right after the Jay Parker episode, which caused a lot of mixed feelings, but I think Jay is a much more credible case and guest than someone like Donald Marshall, or for the real OG fans of THC, those who have dug through the deepest depths of the archives, I think Jay is more credible than someone like Francine Kelly, right? So I don't know. There are things that have always been staples of this show, and interviews with people who claim to have been put through these types of traumas has kind of been one of them. And it's great to get the opinions of a doctor who was really right there at ground zero. We talked about Dr. Ross's personal story and drama just a little bit in the Plus show, and anyone who wants to find out more can obviously do a couple searches and find some dirt, but that's actually true for most of our guests, and sometimes there's something to it, sometimes it's just an attack on someone who's going against the grain, and sometimes it's a little bit of both. Personally, I think if you've been listening to the show for a long time, you know that it's almost always about what a person knows or thinks rather than what a person has done. Does that sound bad? I mean, yeah, our guests have done some great work, but I almost never ask them about personal drama or their negative press or personal matters. I try to build a show around information that is thought-provoking, useful, or interesting, and you can't do much with an exposé on some he-said-she-said stuff. I suppose you can find out a lot about a person's character, but if a person is knowledgeable about a subject and is willing to share that, their character is kind of limited importance. Of course, not zero importance. I'm not saying that. I did have to turn down a guest once that I had already accepted because of some white supremacist organizational ties and a child porn conviction. And you know, had it been one or the other, maybe we could look the other way. But if you're going to go that hard in the paint, I just think I can probably hear about the aquatic ape theory from someone else. But I did like having on Dr. Ross. He definitely has a ton of knowledge in this field, so I hope you dug it. If you only heard the first hour, sign up for Plus to hear the second hour as usual. This time we got into how the mind control cabal and LSD experimentation crowd affected the psychedelic culture of the 60s, strange names and repeating patterns and stories that touch on mind control or Manchurian candidate themes. We also talked about the containment strategy of turning a patient's stories of abuse, rape, and torture back on the psychiatrist, the technological aspects of mind control, gang stalking, and targeted individuals, things we're hearing a lot more about lately, Colin's thoughts on geoengineering and vaccines, which I think are pretty sound, and for good measure, we got into alien abduction from a psychological perspective, as well as Dr. Ross's personal experiences and research into human energy fields. A little different, a little more positive, but all good stuff. If you like the first hour of the Higher Side Chats, yes, it's free, but it's only half the show. And the second hour is just $1, really. $5 for 5 2-hour shows a month. It's the cheapest deal in high-quality conspiratainment, if you ask me. You can also sign up now through Patreon. Just search for the Higher Side Chats there. And I also take signups in, surprise, surprise, a wide variety of cryptocurrencies. Just get the wallet addresses from the signup page and email me your desired username. I'm pretty easy. Hell, I'm sure we can even make a deal for some unwanted holiday gift cards, right? Would you rather have THC Plus for a year than some Gap jeans? Well, let's make a deal. But I guess that's it for me. The year's about to come to a close, one THC left for 2017, a return guest who hasn't been here in, I think, 3 years, who I also think is a great choice for a year-end review, but you'll have to wait to get her name. That's it for me, people. I've done my part. Your move, deep state doctors, mental manipulators, and operators of those nefarious mental hospitals from hell, your fucking move.
You know the plan has always been to hack your brain. MKUltra's trying to drive you insane. They'll explode your heart if they think that's what it takes. You think I'm answering the phone? Well, I ain't. You gotta keep the curtains drawn, 'cause you don't want anyone thinking you're at home. Well, you're not. You should tape the mail slot. And baby, if I seem withdrawn, let me say it's 'cause I just don't wanna go and get whacked. Maybe you should know that the trauma affects you like it does everyone. It's just the game plan, it's what the world's become. They want a pat down and a swap. Don't you see what's going on? Well, now you know. You're better keeping on your own, 'cause you can see the master's lie too much. Oh, baby, you can only trust yourself. And if you think the system's out of touch, it is, and you can only trust yourself. I hope you know the elite aren't your friends. They'll suck out everything from you in the end. And if for some reason you think I might be wrong, I wonder where you got that opinion from. You gotta keep the curtains drawn, 'cause you don't want anyone thinking you're at home. Well, you're not. You should tape the mail slot. And baby, if I seem withdrawn, let me say it's 'cause I just don't wanna go and get whacked. Maybe you should know that the trauma affects you like it does everyone. It's just the game plan, it's what the world's become. They want a pat down and a swap. Don't you see what's going on? Well, now you know. You're better keeping on your own, 'cause you can see the masters lie too much. Oh, baby, you can only trust yourself. And if you think the system's out of touch, it is, and you can only trust yourself. Are small, or maybe they aren't registering at all. Now they know you're naive and vulnerable. You won't believe all of the stunts that they'll pull, 'cause you can see the masters lie too much. Oh, baby, you can only trust yourself. And if you think the system's out of touch, it is, and you can only trust yourself. 'Cause you can see the masters lie too much. Oh, baby, you can only trust yourself. And if you think the system's out of touch, it is, and you can only trust yourself.